You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And thanks, Grant, and welcome to Community Connections. I'm Alan Collier, and it's my pleasure to be with you for the next 2 hours. Actually, three. We've got another interview between one and two, and then we've got Choice Tunes. We've got someone coming in with their favourite songs, and we'll learn a bit about their life, and away we go. But anyway, the first hour, of course, our legal hour. We've always got people from Hutchinson Legal here on the second Wednesday of the month, and I've heard from Grant that he's committed to for you all to come in for the next year, so they'll be back in 2022. We won't be here in January. We always have a break, but we'll be back starting February. But anyway, I have Rachel and Philip from Hutchinson Legal. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Alan.
It's great to have you along. And you're both newbies. We haven't had you before, so we'll see how, well, I'm sure we'll have a lot of fun.
Hope so.
We sent sent you all, or the group in last time with a bit of homework. We had a question from a listener, and they say that, you know, you often read in the paper where a person has stolen from their employee or employer, but then other times others are charged with fraud, and they want to know what's the difference, and what do you have to what's the difference between what you have to prove differently to prove stealing to fraud? I believe you're going to tell us, Philip.
Yes, thank you. So when you're looking at criminal offences, you break them down into their elements, and those are the things that need to be proven for the conviction to be held up in court. So with stealing, we refer to as theft in the Victorian Crimes Act. There are four elements: dishonesty, appropriation, that means taking, just taking something, property, the thing has to be property, and then an intention to permanently deprive, so you don't intend to give it back. That's the four things generally that are required to show theft. Fraud is more of a broad term, so it covers quite a few offences. However, there's two main ones that we look at with fraud: obtaining property by deception and obtaining financial advantage by deception. So the first, obtaining property by deception, actually has three of the same four elements as theft. The only difference is with theft you have appropriation, so generally, again, just taking something, whereas with obtaining property by deception you have the element of deception. But the other three elements are the same, so it has to be dishonest, there has to be some property involved, and there has to be an intention to permanently deprive the person of the property.
All right, so I'm an employee. Pardon me, I've got something caught in the throat. That's not COVID anyway, that's one thing. So I'm an employee and I'm working for you, and I knock off $10,000. So you call the police come in. How do they decide whether I should be charged with stealing or whether I should be charged with fraud?
So let's say that you've opened up a cash register, which for some reason has got $10,000 cash inside it, and you pick it up and you take it home, you'll be charged with theft.
Right, so what if I work in the account section and I take some I write out a few receipts and I take the $10,000?
Yeah, so if you're manipulating the numbers, let's say somehow you've manipulated the numbers to make it look like you're owed $10,000 in wages,
yep,
and your employer pays you $10,000, they willingly pay it to you, you haven't taken it from them, but you've deceived them into giving it over, then you'd be looking at either obtaining property or obtaining financial advantage by deception.
And so what would that be, fraud or...?
That comes under fraud, yeah. So fraud is a much more broad term, though. It's not just those two offences.
So
there are other offences as well.
If it was stock, so I work in a shop and I wear a pair of pants in the morning and I keep putting a nice sports coat on and walk out every night, is that fraud or is that stealing?
That would be stealing. I can't see why that would come under fraud unless there's some deception involved where the property's been willingly given to you but under false pretenses. So you've basically tricked someone into giving it to you. Otherwise, if you've taken it and they don't know and they're not aware of it, or you've taken it, you know, dishonestly, that's going to come under theft or stealing.
Oh, yeah. Beauty. All right. Now, we also did ask you to go away and look at personal guarantees. Somebody comes to you, you're such a nice bloke, and I use the Con was here last time, and he's a nice guy. He's got heaps of money, and I go along and I spin this great tale that I need $10,000. And he thinks, that Alan's all right. I'll loan it to him. What should Con be assured of before he loans me the money so that I don't come back in 6 months' time when Con says, hey, where's my 10 grand? And I say, oh, no, you gave that to me as a gift. How would you cover yourself?
Yeah, so, I mean, if you're entering into a loan contract, you want to have a signed contract, first of all. That'll stop them from saying things like that you've given it to me as a gift, or you had had no intention to repay, or you things relating to interest, to avoid any arguments as to what interest pays. That's going to be included in writing, and that'll cover you down the track. I think an element of the question might have been asking about whether or not the person's given guarantees to other parties. So there's nothing to stop a lender from asking about that. They do have a right to inquire. You can say, I need you to give me this information as a condition of us entering into this loan. In terms of personal guarantees, though, there's not necessarily a way to check. There's not a register of any private personal guarantees given to other people. However, if you're dealing with property, there is. So if it's a home, you can do a land title search.
Yep. All right, let me give you another instance. Mm-hmm. I'm running a business and you come along and you want to trade with me. And we'll say we're working on 30-day contracts or just a normal debt level business to business, right? So I come along to you and I say, well, you're a proprietary limited company, so therefore I want a personal guarantee so that if the company falls over, I can sue you for the 10 grand, right? So I give you credit. We'll say $50,000 a month. Mm-hmm. You're going to pay me 30 days. You sign, you're going to pay 30 days. And I say, well, I'm a bit worried about this because this company's a proprietary limited company. I want a guarantee that if the company falls over, I can come after you. So a lot of people will say, no, I'm not going to do that. That's why I've got a proprietary limited company. Mm-hmm. If it falls over, you trade with them if you don't. But on the hand, what about on the instance where you say, yeah, I'll sign a personal guarantee. That's fine. So away they go, and the business falls over. Now I come back to you, but I've learned that on the assumption that I've got a personal guarantee with you.
Yeah.
And it may be, how do I find out, I guess, that you haven't given another 30 or 40 personal guarantees so that, in fact, while I've got a personal guarantee from you, it's not worth a bumper. And secondly, if the company falls over, is it the first one who sues you personally gets paid, or how does that work? I mean, how do I find out, are there other personal guarantees and what happens if it falls over?
So, as I said, there's nothing to stop you inquiring as to whether or not someone's...
Yeah, but where do I ask? Because the person's not going to tell me.
So you can make it a condition that the person could have to give up certain information, or if you have a suspicion that they've given guarantees to parties that are known to you, you can go and ask them.
Yeah.
But there's not like a specific register that you can just search for all personal private guarantees. But as I said, with property, if someone's put their house up, you can absolutely do a title search, and that will show you any guarantees given over that property. And same with even personal property, so cars, boats, even expensive artworks can be put up as security for guarantees, and they're listed under the personal property security.
But I can't guarantee that there are not... I can't find out. There's nowhere I can go where these things are registered so that I know that I'm only one of three people or something. I can't do that.
Not necessarily for private guarantees,
Oh, no, even just business. I'm talking about business now.
Yes, but, if there's no property involved, if it's just personal, then no. Yeah.
Now I've got Rachel and Philip with me. Rachel, you want to tell us about a few changes to the Family Law Court? Act or whatever it is?
Yes, thanks, Alan. Yes, there has been some pretty major developments this year on the 1st of September. What was the Family Court and what was the Federal Circuit Court have now merged. What that actually means for people going to court is that there is one entry point now. There's one set of forms. It's just going to make things a lot simpler when people actually get to court. But that's just the rebranding side of things. There's also a refocusing of resources.
In what way, Rachel?
Well, just trying to deter people from going to court unnecessarily. So there's a lot more hoops that need to be jumped through before you can even apply to court. It's an expectation that there's some form of alternative dispute resolution, like a mediation, not necessarily with the involvement of lawyers, but sometimes that's appropriate too if it's a bit more guided. In financial cases especially, that there be some kind of disclosure that you've asked for some financial documents to make sure that the property pool is all accounted for and make sure that everyone's negotiating over the same property pool. So to make sure that, yeah, everything's accounted for, everything's on the table and parties can negotiate freely. Now, that's obviously when things go according to plan.
When it goes,
Yes. Obviously, that's not going to be appropriate in every situation. Sometimes you call and you're trying to start these negotiations and no one's participating on the other side. So once you've at least requested those things, you've asked for the disclosure, it hasn't been provided, you've tried to initiate a mediation and someone said, nope, I don't want to be involved, then you can put someone on notice and take them to court. But you still have to take all of those steps. You can't immediately go to court other than in emergencies.
Rachel, this is probably a bit unfair to ask you on the spot. These matters, what percentage do you, or a rough guess, what percentage of would be finalised at mediation compared to that, to the 100% that you start off with? How many percent would go to court?
I mean, of those that come to us anyway, it's usually because there's some sort of dispute. I mean, if there's no issues, then they don't even come to us in the first place. But of those that get legal advice, very few go to court. If they do go to court, they're usually resolving in the early stages of court. It's too early to say whether these new mechanisms and encouragements that the courts are doing and the new hurdles to jump through, it's too early to say whether that's going to entirely shift it. But previously, under the old system, you would absolutely resolve things at that mediation stage. So hence the intention that you have that mediation and some form of negotiations before you even get to court.
So is the court really the last step? Is that what they're trying to make it?
Absolutely. It's a last resort. And you can see why. Anyone who's gone through it will tell you that it's expensive, it's time-consuming, and above all, it's stressful. Particularly when particularly in family law, there's a lot of tension between the parties.
Terrific.
It can be.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to the Legal Hour, and I should make a quick mention if you've got a quick legal question. We can't talk about particular cases, but we can talk about aspects of the law. Philip, you wanted to talk a bit about intervention orders.
Thanks, Alan. Yeah, so just leading on, Rachel was talking a bit about family law before. I work in our litigation department, and we have a bit of overlap there with intervention orders. So they are often involved in family law matters, but generally it's our litigation department that handles intervention orders, particularly if that's all that's happening, if it's just an intervention order matter. Yeah. Yep. So there's two major kinds of intervention orders. The first and probably the most common being family violence intervention orders, or FVIOs.
Who applies for those? The police or the person themselves?
It can be either, actually. So the police, it's essentially up to them if they want to. They usually will in family violence situations. But at the end of the day, they have discretion to say, no, we're not going to apply for an order on your behalf. The advantage of the police doing it is obviously that it's free. You don't have to pay the police. But if they haven't done it, then you can either do it yourself, which is obviously not recommended, or you can engage a lawyer to do it for you.
All right. So let me just throw a quick question at you, because you know a fair bit about this. There's an incident tonight. Husband and wife get into a big barney, and the wife's really frightened, so she rings the police. Mm-hmm. Who, like, we'll say it's 11 o'clock at night, so can they get an intervention order at that time of night? Like, can the police issue one themselves or just have to go to court? So what happens that overnight?
So they can't issue it on the spot. It does have to go to court, but it's usually very quick. So the court will, in fact, all the magistrates court, I believe, have an intervention order registry, so they have an entire department just for intervention orders because they get so many. Yep. And they estimate, I mean, we had one recently where the estimated turnaround time was 10 days. That wasn't for a family violence one though, so they might be quicker even than for a family violence. But it does have to go through the court overnight. It depends on what's... If the person's committed a crime, the police will probably arrest them. You know, if there's been a serious assault, then that's a separate issue and they'll be charged for that assault if the police are satisfied there's evidence to do that. Yep. But the intervention order will proceed separately. Yeah. But if there's not, if they're not charging the person, it might be that, you know, it can be very minor incidents that lead to intervention orders. Again, it's that the police's whim if they decide to do it or not. It could be a minor argument. Police step in, you know, it settles down. There's no, even if there's no physical violence, if there's just a lot of yelling, and then maybe 4 or 5 days later, a letter will turn up and say there's an intervention order against you and you have to leave your house. You can't live here anymore.
Right. So can that be challenged?
Absolutely, yeah. So that's what's called an interim order. It's not a final order.
Right.
But because with family violence, there's usually a need for urgency, the court will put in an interim order. So it's sort of like a temporary order that protects the person immediately. Otherwise, they have to wait months and months and they're not protected for that time.
So that's based on basing the police, is it? Like the police would be the one that would give that information to the court to get the temporary order?
Yeah, well, they're essentially basically acting as the lawyer in that circumstance. They're applying on the person's behalf. So if you engage a lawyer to do it, then your lawyer can apply to the court for you. And again, then the person will be served with an interim order. If the court's satisfied that you have a valid claim for an order, within a few days.
All right, so let's just go back just a tick. So we've got the police turn up at 11 o'clock at night. There's an incident and they want to do something about it. So the police takes a person away. But if it's still going to take 4 or 5 days, what protects the person, or we'll say the lady, because it's very often the lady, what protects her for those in between? Because even if he gets charged with an offence, they keep him overnight, they bail him the next day, we'll say. What then, what happens over the next 4 or 5 days?
If he's been bailed, then there's going to be more consequences for the person, first of all, for doing anything else, because they'll be in breach of bail. So there's higher consequences associated, which can help protect them a bit more. But obviously some people don't care about that and they're just going to keep doing these sort of things. So essentially they're not protected other than being able to call the police again until that order comes in and is served on the person. But the court, it does have to go through the court, yeah.
All right, so we always like to send you away with a bit of a challenge. So we've had a call from a client, or from a listener today, not a client. You have the clients, we have the listeners. This person, let me just set up a little scenario. Very often you'll see when you're driving around the subjects, an old car on the side of the road, out the front of a house, probably been there a couple of years, something went wrong, they drove it home and they've gone off and bought another car and it sat there. After a while, somebody rings the council and says, look, you know, this car's an eyesore. So the council come down, and we're not challenging the council's ability to do it because there'll be a bylaw. They put a sign on it, and they say, if this car's not moved in 14 days, we're going to come and collect it and dispose of it. Nothing happens. They rock up. They hook the truck up. They send it out to an auction house, sits here for whatever time it has to sit there, and it goes to auction, and it's sold. My understanding is a lot of those cars are sold to wreckers, because then the wrecker buys them, he takes them, he pulls it apart, and that car no longer exists. We've got a case where it was an older car, something like 45, 50 years old. So while it's a bit of a wreck, it is worth money if it's done up. So the council come along, they stick the signature sign on it, they pick it up and away it goes, winds up at the auction house, it's auctioned off. Now, who still owns that car? Because there's a problem here that these old cars, you can spend $45,000, $50,000 to do them up. And when they're done up, they can be worth quite a bit of money. Now, this person's bought it, and he says, well, if I go and spend all this money, plus 1,000 hours at least, putting it all together and that, can the person come along and say, well, that's still my car, because, you know, they've got the engine number and all that sort of stuff. We'll say it's seen at a car show or seen somewhere, but they're able to prove it's their car. How does that go? Because the owner has never agreed to get rid of it. It's been picked up. Now, we're not arguing that the council can't do it. It's gone through a legal process. But does that transfer the ownership to the council when they pick it up? And the person says, I don't want to spend all this money. And then someone come along and say, right, that's my car. So that's the first question. So leading on to that, I was thinking about this question. So I'll put another scenario to you. This time a guy goes out and he buys an old car. He takes it home and he puts it on his front, not on his nature strip, only in the front of his house. Nobody cares, the neighbours don't care. And one day when I got some money, he says, I'm going to do it up. Comes home one night and it's knocked off. So it's gone. It's not registered, not insured, no nothing. So he rings the police and the police say, well, we can't check it. Well, we don't think about it. So it then goes to the situation, the same thing. It's whoever knocked it off sticks it on the side of the road somewhere because it's all too hard. So same scenario, the council come along, they put the sticker on. If it's not gone in within 14 days, we'll take it, and it goes through the auction. Now, same thing, if a person bought that car, takes it home and spends 1,000 hours and 45,000 on, who still has the legal right that car? Because bear in mind, it was stolen when it started. It's gone through the council, but they can't give it a clear title because they never owned it. Because normally when you buy a car, you either buy from a car yard who owns the car or you buy it privately and they own the car. This one's got no legal ownership on it because they've picked it up. It's been through the auction. They're only auctioning someone else's car off. Comes out the other end. So we need, and I think that's going to be a fairly lengthy one to look at that. I know Grant laughs because he said we often get questions about cars, but I think this one's has really got a problem about it because you don't want to be spending $45,000 and you can do 1,000 to 2,000 hours work on them. And what happens if it's at a car show and a guy comes up and says, that's my car, that was stolen 10 years ago. I've got the number, I've got the engine number, I've got the chassis number, and we check it and it's his car. Who owns it?
That's interesting. I think it's definitely going to need some research.
Mm.
The question for the first part, I think, is does the council get ownership? Does the property transfer to the council, first of all, when they pick it
up
and take it?
I would think not, but I don't know.
Yeah, we'd have to look at the like you said, the relevant bylaws.
Yep.
And for the second part, it's, if it does, then does that person who had it stolen have some sort of retained right? We'd need to look into that. We'll get the get that right next time.
So we like to send you away with a bit of challenge, and there's a good challenge.
It's a great challenge. Definitely. Yeah.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
First of all, we should say thank you to Hutchinson Legal, particularly Grant, for supplying people with us for the whole 11 months of the year. We've had a lot of fun with them, and I guess they're all still with the company, so we can't have given them too hard a time. But thanks, Grant, and I know that you've committed to another 12 months. That'll be fantastic. We won't be here in January, but we'll be here for the other 11 months of the year. Philip, we were talking about intervention orders, and we got on to the family violence, but you say there are other sorts of intervention orders as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, in case any of the listeners are having any problems with people outside their family, you can also get what's called a personal safety intervention order. So that's where you have somebody who's harassing or doing some sort of dangerous conduct, stalking, even physical abuse, but they're not a member of your family. They might be your neighbours, is a lot of it. Sometimes people throw things over the fence and cause all sorts of nuisance. Then you can apply. Again, the police can do it. Or you can do it yourself through a lawyer. You can apply for an intervention order, and then they'll be served. If it's accepted, they'll be served with an interim order.
What sort of things would it cover, Phil?
So it can be verbal abuse, psychological abuse, harassment, even online. It can be online harassment. It's just the main thing is that there's a course of conduct, so a repeated pattern. You can't just have one person says something wrong to you. You can't just get an intervention order straight away, but. Mm-hmm. Also, if they've physically attacked you or if threatened you as well on multiple occasions,
Would that intervention order keep them away from you physically or does it cover Facebook or what does it cover?
It can be both. So usually there'll be a requirement that you don't come within a certain radius of the person or
even if the person hasn't threatened you up front, like in face-to-face, even if they just made threats or called.
It could be left out if it's only online. It'd be up to the judge at the end of the day, but it wouldn't necessarily exclude that sort of thing. But they can also have something like the person can't post anything online about them, or can't use a phone to contact them, or can't post photos of them, that sort of thing. That can be included in the order.
So where would they person go to get that? Do they go to the local magistrate's court, or where do they apply for that?
Yep, so same as family violence. You fill out your application, or a lawyer will fill out the application for you, and you'll submit that to the magistrate's court, yep.
And will he listen to, like, say you're going for a personal one, would he then call the other person in and want to hear their side of the story?
Not to get the interim. To get the interim, it can be heard without the other person, just to get the protection in place. But then you have what's called a mention hearing, where the final order is sought to be put in place, and that's where the person gets a chance to say, here's why you shouldn't put the order in place.
And how long would there be the difference between the interim order and the full order?
Depends on how busy the court is, but it can be months, yeah.
Because is it true that the courts are up to 2 years behind on some of this stuff?
It depends. There are different priorities. So as I've said, like, they'll prioritise getting interim orders in because it's important to protect people. But for some matters, 2 years could be where they're up to.
And if an intervention order, whether it be for any of them, whether it be family violence or personal ones, do they have an end by date? Like,
they don't last indefinitely. It might be 12 months, it might be 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. If someone was seeking for 10 or 15 years, you'd probably have an argument to say, hey, that's onerous, and get that changed if someone was trying to get one against you for that long, yeah.
So if you've got one, we'll say it's a domestic violence, any of them. So if it's in place for 12 months, so do they court automatically just squash it, and you have to go back and reapply?
So the order will cease to be in effect by a certain date. The only reason you could get another one is if they've continued the conduct, in which case they'll be charged.
But they might have continued it because they've taken notice of the individual. But on the other hand, if they don't, then just apply for another one.
Yeah, if they picked up the conduct again, you could apply for another one. I'm sure the court would put more strict requirements on if that was the case.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, look, that's fantastic. Thank you to Philip. Thank you to Rachel for coming in with us, and we look forward to perhaps seeing you as part of the group next year.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.